Hello, my name is Marie Bilodeau, and you are listening to On the Edge.
Bonjour, Marie.
Bonjour. How are you, Nina? I'm good,
oh,
you?
Very, very good. In fact, I just have come from Paris, where I was researching the current book that I am writing, actually. So.
Really? Yeah. All the way from Paris to here, right?
All the way from Paris. So I was speaking quite a bit of French there, sort of revamping my French. I'm originally from Quebec, but I kind of lost my French when I came out here to Vancouver. And it was really nice to go back and speak that language. I think it's a gorgeous, gorgeous language. I think it's the most romantic, speaking of sexy, the most romantic language in the world.
I completely agree.
Oh, good. I'm glad you do.
That's kind of interesting.
And even someone who speaks English with a French accent, I think that's even more sexy.
You know, I've heard that before.
Have you? Okay, there you go. Well, then you're in good company.
That's kind of interesting, actually, that you mentioned that you come from Quebec. And Darwin's Paradox is kind of based in Ontario and Quebec mostly. And you just said that you were researching in Paris for your next novel. Now, do you usually base your books in settings that you're familiar with personally?
I guess if I'm looking at my past history of what I've written, it's actually 50%. I like to do that, and I think I probably will from now on, mainly because I like to go to exotic places and have excuses to go to them. No, I'm just kidding. But other books that I've written aren't, and mainly because I can't go into outer space.
Tough that.
There you go. But yeah, generally speaking, I like to do that mainly because I am, not mainly, but just so happens that I am a researcher by my other job that I do, my day job as an environmental consultant. I work in science. I'm a scientist. And I love to research. And I like books that have, that are grounded in something that's real. And so that's the kind of stuff I like to write as well. That's why I write science fiction, perhaps more so than fantasy per se. I like the idea that the book has something that's real in it, and then it takes off from that into the world of premise, if you will.
Wonderful. That that definitely shows in Darwin's Paradox, where it's set about 100 years in the future from now.
Yep.
And can you tell us a little bit about Darwin's Paradox and the inspirations you got from there? I mean, you're a scientist, and that definitely comes through to the level of detail. But can you tell us a bit, like, where the original idea came from and how you developed it from there?
Oh, goodness. Okay. Good question. The book really developed over many, many years for me. In fact, I could even start it when I was a little kid doing radio shows with my sister. We were just, you know, using our imagination. We created, we had dolls and stuff and stuffed animals, and we literally created worlds. I guess I did most of the creating. My sister went along with it. She enjoyed it. We had a cast of thousands of characters, and you know, little bunnies, and that's what they were, but we made them into aliens and stuff, right? And they just traveled the universe, and I was just fascinated by the whole concept of space and space travel. I think I wanted to be an astronaut. Oh. An astronaut at one point. Ray Bradbury is my hero. He writes metaphorically gorgeous stuff. Everything, every word has meaning, right? Every scene tells us a mini story, takes you places. Darwin's Paradox, I mean, that one could go on ad nauseum about the title itself. It has many meanings, anything from the literal to the main character, who is in fact a paradox of Darwin. There's a lot of paradox in the book. But it's, you know, Darwin's Paradox. Darwin, if you think of Darwin, it's evolution and it's nature. I'm an environmental consultant, and I'm a lover of nature first, and that's why I went into consulting and went into science. Sort of wanted to, I don't know, not save the world so much. I didn't think it needed saving so much as needed stewardship.
Oh.
And I devoted myself to that, even though I started off thinking I was going to be an artist, which I guess I still am. But back in college, I distinctly remember a place where something happened, which has stayed with me for a long time and sort of come full circle with me. I had before I went into the master's program and pursued, you know, a more formal and more directed approach to science, well, everyone was talking to each other. Oh, what are you going to do? You know, what are you, why are you here? Why are you in the sciences, and where are you going to go, and what kind of career are you going to go for? And this one fellow, very bright, actually, it turns out he was an art student, just dabbling in science, and as opposed to, usually it's the other way around. Usually these science people dabble a little bit in the arts just to take something, something easier for them, you know.
More creative.
You don't usually see an artist, someone in the arts, dabbling into science just for the fun of it. And this fellow was doing that. He was obviously a brilliant, a very bright fellow. But he also had a funny side to him. So, you know, he asked me what I was going to do, and I had already made a decision. I was going to go do master's in some area, which I won't bore you with the details. And I asked him back, what was he going to do? And he looked at me, you know, very straightforwardly, almost serious, and said, I'm going to make algae sing. That's my hope to do, my ambition. And I looked at him like, you got to be crazy, guy. Okay, this is something only an art student would tell me, right? But you know, he's a brilliant guy. I have no idea where he went. I really wish I got to check up, see if I can find him on Facebook or something. But the point was that it stayed with me. It sat with me, and I thought, wow, you know, there's a lot more out there than we're willing to give credit to or have been. And science is now starting to delve into those areas. Wild and wonderful that's in some cases almost, in fact, is borderlining onto the areas of metaphysics, looking at clairvoyance, telekinesis, those kind of things. There are physicists out there that are actually starting to explain those kind of phenomena, paranormal phenomena, with real science.
Interesting.
They have terms for them, and they're describing them. And I do have them on my blog, by the way. You can go there and check them out. People like Rupert Sheldrake, who has come up with terms and explanations, as a matter of fact. Like I said, again, Nobel laureate, people who have won the Nobel Prize, switched over, physicists, famous physicists, who, you know, they're looking up things like that. To go back to Darwin, that's a lot of the concepts, the things that I just mentioned to you, are all in Darwin's paradox, and they do explain and describe paradox, essentially, which is what that book is really all about.
Interesting. So for you, do you see, was Darwin's paradox more of a chance to explore what could be, or did you write it more as a cautionary tale to your readers?
Excellent question. It's more what could be. There is some cautionary stuff in there, but it is actually more a book of optimism rather than a book of pessimism, which often cautionary tales are, right?
Like, yeah.
A good example is Margaret Atwood's Oryx and Crake is very much a cautionary tale. It's an almost sordid tale. I don't know if you've read it. My book sort of grazes that area, and it can get gritty and stuff, but it always, I think, comes above that, and certainly where it comes together toward the end goes to a place that is very much optimistic.
Interesting. Now, can you tell us a little bit about the character of Julie? Now, Julie's having a really hard time in this book. You certainly don't pull your punches when it comes to this character, but she's very interesting and very well-shaped in everything that comes out from her and from the actions she's taking in the book and from the decisions she's taken in the past as well. Can you tell us a little bit what it was like living in her head?
Well, at no given time was I constantly living in her head. I was living in two or three other people's heads, too.
Okay.
When I was writing these, which kind of helped me. A lot of people, it's not that they didn't like her, but, I mean, hopefully that's not the case. She's the heroine, the main character. But a lot of them would say, oh, well, my favorite character was actually Angel. Or, actually, I had a lot of people say that. Or my favorite character is so-and-so on this character, and I really hated Frank, and blah, blah, blah. He was such a schmuck. And whatever. But I have to say, all the characters are me, of course. I mean, I wrote them, right?
Yeah.
And they're different aspects of me. They are also aspects of other people that I've observed, and I've, you know, changed them and put them in. Not that I should be naming names, not to that extent. But there are definitely aspects of her character that I see in me, and I drew upon that. And I have, you know, I have a teenage son. Some of the issues with the mother and the daughter can be clearly similar to some issues that I might have had with my son. One of them, I'll just openly say, you know, the whole issue of control.
Oh.
I think every parent has that with their teenage kid, perhaps more so than when they're younger.
Yeah.
And those are things that have to be resolved. So the whole parent-child thing, I certainly drew from reality, from my own experience, and my own issues. And in terms of science and, you know, where she ends up going, there are issues of trust and self-respect and those kind of things, which I drew upon and made my own synthesis of. Her journey and her reaction to science is very much my background. I probably used a couple of other characters as my mouthpiece more so, right?
Now I have a very important question for you. Maybe one of the most important you'll ever get. Okay, this is for new readers. So I'm a new reader. I just picked up Darwin's Paradox, and I'm ready to go sit down somewhere and read for the day. The whole day will be read away with your book. Now, what would you as the author recommend to that newest of readers to be the perfect drink to have while reading your book?
Oh, goodness gracious me. Well, you know, the answer comes to me immediately.
Oh.
A wonderful, deep, rich, red wine. Either a lovely Bordeaux or, even better, a Bourgogne Pinot Noir.
Oh, is that part of the inspiration from just coming back from France?
Yes, I'm afraid it is. I shouldn't say I'm afraid. Yes, definitely.
Where can we find out a bit more about you and kind of keep up with your progress on the web?
Right. Well, there are two sites. One is my personal blog, and it's very easy to remember. It's called The Alien Next Door.
Okay.
If you Google that, I appear first, so that's not a problem. I have another, my manager is running a site devoted to the book itself. It's called Darwin's Paradox, run by Karen Mason. And it has, not only does it have podcasts of the early chapters so people can get a feel for the book by listening to it simply, but it also gives information about where I'm at, what I'm doing right now, appearances, interviews. And I put the odd review on there and writer's tips and those kind of things. So it's actually quite rich in that kind of stuff.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, thank you very much, Nina. You've been a pleasure to have here on The Edge.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Take care.
Okay, Marie. Many thank yous. All right, bye-bye.
Bye.